So the pair of readings for this section of the course were the interview with Bernabé Confiant and Chamasso called titled Créolité Bites, which was published in the journal Transition. And then also paired with that is an essay, which is one of my favorite essays just in terms of the questions it raises, an essay by Maurice Condé, Order, Disorder, Freedom, and the West Indian Rider. I will say this about the Créolité Bites interview. It's, for me, in some ways, I actually believe this, as important as the manifesto in terms of the sheer information and insight contained in it. I like to keep them separate, and I wanted to keep them separate in terms of the flow of the course, because the manifesto has a certain kind of quality to it that is aspirational and declarative. But what we find in the Créolité Bites interview is the same sense of the declarative, but also a kind of combativeness. What I want out of that combativeness, because I think it's important, is a sense of what they feel like after the publication of the manifesto, after its presentation at a conference, a sense of what they understood to be the critical response and how they were going to push back against it, but also how I think if you read the two pieces together, you can see some fundamental modifications of their position in the interview, modifications of In Praise of Creoleness. I think a really great essay could be written that just really sat down and mapped out those differences and what they mean and what the significance of that shift is. I will say just this much, that I think what the manifesto risks, I don't know that it's committed to it, but risks, and I talked about it last time and we talked about it extensively in seminar, is what it risks is an ontologization of the Caribbean subject, that is literally thinking about Caribbean subjectivity as a fixed or calcified sense of being. And that what Creole is then is an adjective or a noun that fixes a sense of being. I do believe that when we get to the interview, they've softened that quite a bit, and that they really are trying to talk about freeing the imagination. And in freeing the imagination, this idea that the imagination can more deeply connect both to a sense of small place, which is my fixation and obsession in talking about the manifesto. Say something about this notion of the small place, but also connect in important ways to what it means to be Caribbean, what it means to be in these creolized spaces. And that sense of connection is both what makes the manifesto's heavy lean towards ontological language. It's a heavy investment in an articulation of being, which, by the way, just as an aside, when I say that articulation of a sense of being, you know, it does start off and it says, we are not, but we are. That use of the copula, right? Are not and are. That's that moment where you know that it's invested with a deep sense of being. And I like that investment in a deep sense of being because I think it's a risk worth taking. It stakes out a position. It's a position that's more provocative and incites debates in ways that I think Glissant's notion of creolization does not. But it also, in doing so, sets the terms for, the way they put it, as for a West Indian literature that is true to West Indian experience in the contemporary. In the contemporary, I think, is really important, and part of why also the risk of a strong ontology is worth it in my mind. Because when we think about the phases of Caribbean life, and the way so much of the theory from the mid-century and immediately after, sort of the 40s through the 1960s, are about, and into the 1970s, is so much about that tension between the colonial and anti-colonial and decolonial, Right. So what so much that came before the Creolists and came really before Glissant and Brathwaite and Walcott is grappling with the presence literally of the colonizer, the presence literally of anti-colonial or liberation or independence struggle. And then in the terms of the decolonial, thinking about how do we imagine ourselves in the midst of colonialism in a way that is not bound by colonialism. That's an impossible imagination. That's something that I think it's fair to say no one could quite do. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's not a criticism at all. That's just a description of what it means to live in the present. No one can write a history of the present. No one can write a history of what is happening and say, this is who we have been and who we are. In moments of conflict, in moments of independence struggle, and in this case, it's independence struggle after centuries of slavery and colonialism. So this is not a, you know, a two generation sort of struggle. In that moment, all we can really see, and this is true of most radical political movements, anti-colonial movements were extremely radical. They upended the structure of the world as it had been for centuries. And in those moments of negation, the anti and anti-colonial, all we can really see is a juxtaposition or a dialectic, right? Which is the way things have been and what we now refuse to let them be. And then what's set forward from that is an imagination that's either articulated or foreclosed, you know, in principle, because we can't know the future, or maybe somebody risks knowledge of the future or risks a prediction of the future. But either way, all we can get out of that tension between the anti-colonial and the colonial is a sense of what cannot be. And then imagine out of what cannot be the kinds of things that might be. The Creolists write in the manifesto and then discuss in the Creolite Bites interview. They're working from a context of longstanding, just in terms of lifetimes of writers, in that milieu, a couple of generations removed from anti-colonial struggle. So they really live in the post-colonial, where colonial domination is no longer a fabric of everyday life. And it lives on in neo-colonial relations like departmentalization. And they talk about that. We've talked about that. But in the end, I think they're writing from this very different position where it's like, it's time for us to stop talking about what we are not and to talk about what we are, what and who we are. And when you say what and who we are, that's an ontological question. That's a question about the nature of being, in this case of our being as Caribbeans. So that for me is a risk worth taking, and it's also for me the appropriate question to ask in the particular post-colonial moment they find themselves in. Okay, so if we stop there and say, you know, this is worth risking this question of who and what we are because we are post-colonial, not anti-colonial anymore, any longer, then I think we see something that's really important about Condé's critique in her essay. And her essay has a really important question about the nature of literature and the kinds of things we ought to expect from it. And that the gender critique is super important. It's not super important just because gender critique is always important, which is true, but it's super important because it again asks the question that the Creolists are asking, even if she takes it in a different direction, asks the question that they're asking, which is, who and what are we in our literature, since it's a literary question, who and what are we in our literature? In other words, who and what should we find in our literature in order for that literature to be of us, by us, and about us? Well, that's where this question of, you know, she uses the examples, and they're extremely illuminating this way because they're just so viscerally different. That's why the question of sexuality and sexual pleasure is so important to her, Because when you have that representation of who and what we are, and it's only a masculine perspective, then something as intimate as one's own desires, one's own pleasures, one's own body, one's own relation to other human beings, when that's closed off to only be one story, right? One gendered story. However varied that story might be, because just because it's, you know, a series of literary works from a male perspective doesn't mean they're all the same, but it does mean that they are all leveled off in some really profound way. And by leveled off, I just mean it has no dimensionality to it, which the question of gender interjects and helps us understand. So if we get to that point, right, in understanding the relationship between Condé's essay and the Creolist interview, I think we can see both part of their hostility towards Condé and other critics who are similarly minded. Part of that, you know, we can do some, I think, very easy and by them very well earned. Sort of psychology of gender and say, you know what, these guys really are sort of set into a frenzy by a woman critic who is affirming women's sexuality. I think that is absolutely something that's at work in the criticism of Condé. Right. I think there's no doubt about that. But I think there's a deeper answer, and this really comes back to some of the questions we've been asking across the seminar in terms of the question of diaspora and locality. Because the question of diaspora and locality is really where the difference between the Creolists and Condé come out. And it's one that they think is very important, but it's also one that she thinks is important, right? So who and what we are as West Indians is already this really complicated question, which is, you know, what is the voice of the diaspora in articulating the reality of the indigenous? And that's their term, so we'll use it. Indigenous meaning the people on the actual islands. And what's interesting to me is that this criticism of them in Condé's essay, saying, you know, they don't take account of diasporic perspectives, or they downplay or demean or whatever diasporic perspectives, is, you know, really an important it's an important critical question, because it's a critical question that asks, like, what is the being of Caribbean? Is it something that just lasts throughout diaspora, right? That persists. And so diasporic voices ought to have an equivalent voice in all of this. Or actually, is the question of diaspora a question of a completely different kind of being, a different kind of creature, who in their own way is the kind of being who requires their own discourse, right? Do diasporic writers just require their own discourse and not require the discourse of indigeneity? And those two ought to stand different. I think about this when I read the closing two paragraphs of Condé's essay. So I'm going to read it here and then make a couple of comments on it by way of conclusion. She writes, and this is on 164 at the bottom of her essay, she has a quote from Maurice Blanchot about the nature of literature. And in doing that, in that quotation, following that quotation, she says, "On the contrary, in the West Indies, literature seems to exist to provide the reader with a few reassuring images of himself and his land. Although West Indian literature proclaims to be revolutionary and to be able to change the world, on the contrary, writer and reader implicitly agree about the respecting stereotypical portrayal of themselves and their society. In reality, does the writer wish to protect the reader and himself against the ugliness of the past, the hardships of the present, and the uncertainty of the future? Can we expect the liberation of the West Indian writer in the years to come?" Éloge de la Créolité gives a negative answer. However, other forces are at work, such as the new mentality of our youth and our increased contacts with the rest of the world, especially the Americas. Among the writers themselves, a few dissenting voices, not just female voices, although still covered by those of the majority, make themselves heard and give cause for hope. Now, I find this to be one of the most fascinating passages in the course, because what she's essentially saying here is that what the Creolists want in giving a Creole literary tradition life, what they're actually asking for, what they're actually proposing, is something more like a positive, or she calls it reassuring, image of self and land. Now, you know, where she gets that idea that that's what they're up to is my own kind of question, right? There are all kinds of ways that Confiant and Chamusot make literary representations. Some of them are, you know, reassuring, and some of them are disconcerting, and there's a lot in between. But I think what she's getting at there is that the emphasis on Creole and Creole life in those literary works, right, and the portrait of land. So a novel like Chamusot's Texaco is so important here, because it's so deeply embedded in nature, that she sees that as a desire for something reassuring. Whereas what they are really getting at in that interview and in the manifesto, but especially pointedly, I think, in the interview, I mean, somewhat indirectly, but they have such a point of emphasis this way, is that actually it's just a description of island life. It's just a description of island life. The fact that Condé sees it as a, quote, reassuring image of himself is actually its own kind of criticism that she's unable to see in thinking about the literary works this way. She is unable to see how those works are simply portraits. And the fact that she can't see them as portraits and only see them as some sort of ideological mirage says to the Creolists that she doesn't live on the island. That for her, there's nothing at stake in the representation of what life is like on the island. Literally, she has nothing at stake in that. But for those who live on the island, everything is at stake. And it's interesting to me the way this particular response by Condé, and then the response by Bernabé, Chamusot, and Confiant, though mostly Chamusot and Confiant on this literary point, is really about what kind of people, I should say, what kind of people have rights to claim Caribbean identity in their literature? And the diasporic assertion is problematic politically, I think, as much as I love Condé and really love her literature. I love this essay. I think in this point that she really fails to raise the politically problematic question of what it means for diasporic writers to lay claims to islands they haven't lived in years, if not decades. Because, again, she gives her own... she answers her own question by thinking the own question of, or an answer to this question of, like, you know, what's at stake in thinking from a diasporic perspective and making prescriptions about the island's self-representation. We see that exactly in that moment, that she thinks it's merely a reassuring image, rather than the first time that that kind of life has been put into literary work. So for me, you know, and this is more on the evaluative rather than analytical and comparative mode, I just think for all of the excesses of the Creolists, my own sense of their excesses, and there are a number, I wouldn't say many, but there are a number that I could, you know, get into in a separate conversation. But I think that their essential insight is correct, that diasporic writers don't have the same things at stake as indigenous writers. What unfortunately that means is that we've entered now into a battle of who can lay claim to West Indianness or Caribbeanness, right? And if we, you know, there is another possibility here, but it's a possibility that largely diasporic writers don't take seriously, don't embrace, and seem to have an almost negative, if not absolutely negative, interest in. Namely, they could lay claim to that category, diasporic Caribbean writer, as its own category. And it's so interesting to me because in the United States, we flirt with that category sometimes with African-American writers in the mid-century. We would call them writers from exile or artists from exile. And we think about them mostly in Paris, but sometimes in Accra or Algiers and Istanbul and other parts of the world where largely Black writers would go and write about the United States, but from that perspective, and we often give that characterization, right? Exile. Why don't we just embrace that notion of diasporic writer and say diasporic West Indianness or diasporic Caribbeanness is worthy of its own critical and literary category and all the meanings and analyses that attend to it? It's a tough question because those writers who write from the diaspora, their own literature is such an emphatic and aggressive claim to authentic Caribbeanness. So to give that up is a massive undertaking, just psychologically, ethically, and even I would guess for them politically. But it does leave me with the question. It's a question for, I, in some ways, exit the course with and exit this cluster of material with, which is, you know, who has a right to the claim of Caribbeanness? And what does it mean to think indigeneity and diaspora both together and against itself? And what would it mean to simply embrace, to simply affirm this notion of Caribbeanness as a diasporic, diasporic Caribbeanness as a category without defensiveness or aggression against those who still live there? It seems to be something that diasporic writers and frankly diasporic people don't want to give up. There's something so important about claims to authenticity when it comes to Caribbeanness. But if you don't live there, I do think the Creolists haunt that claim, and they haunt it for important and legitimate reasons. They haunt it because it's the real question, you know, and I'll just put it bluntly as a way of ending this, which is, who are you, the diasporic writer, to say who and what we are, who actually live, breathe, and move in this space?